we're playing the New Zealand rock band The Found on Take It From Us as our theme tune for our mental health radio program. They're a trio of Kiwi musicians, two of whom are mental health consumers. Let's listen to some more of their track, Long Gone. Welcome to Take It From Us on Planet FM 104.6, your mental health access radio program brought to you by Framework and the Like Minds Like Mind program. I'm Sheldon Brown, your host on Take It From Us for the next hour. And today's guest is probably the most acknowledged specialist in mental health we've ever had on Take It From Us. Not only do his credentials spread to hundreds of pages on the internet, in fact I think there were 11,000 references on Google, but he's also a recognised spokesman on psychiatric issues in the United States. He's also a media and legal commentator on high-profile television stations such as CNN, which we get on Sky here in New Zealand, and Court TV. He's Dr. Joseph Del Tito, who is here in New Zealand as a guest of the Phobic Trust. Welcome to Take It From Us, Joe, and to New Zealand as well.
Gee, it's great to be here again.
Good. You're described on the internet as a physician, a forensic psychiatrist, professor, and social and cultural commentator. Formerly at Brown and Harvard Cornell Medical Schools, you currently devote your time to the clinical treatment of patients in Greenwich, Connecticut, and serve as a full professor at New York Medical College. And I gather that we were talking in the car as we came here, you also treated some of the families from the 9/11 incident.
Yes, quite a few. Greenwich is about 30 miles outside of New York City. It's a bedroom community. Most of the people who live there work in New York City, many in the financial industry, so the town was very hard hit.
Right, yeah. So your visit to New Zealand, you want to throw a bit of fishing in, I gather, but what
yes,
else?
Yes, I'm hoping to go up to the Bay of Islands on the weekend. Other than that, I'm here hosted by the Phobic Trust, run by a rather amazing woman, Marcia Reed, who you know, who's a real force to reckon with and who is one of the leading, if not the leading, mental health advocate, certainly that I know of, in New Zealand. And over on Morningside Drive, there's the Phobic Trust in Auckland, and they do a lot of very good work, exceptionally good work, with people with anxiety, phobic, obsessive compulsive disorders.
Is that an area where you've used your psychiatric expertise?
Yeah, it's one of my areas of expertise, primarily anxiety and what we call affective disorders. Affective disorders would be made up of depression and what most people would recognize as manic depression. So those are my main areas of expertise.
This sort of brings us on to the labels that are used in mental health, isn't it? Manic depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. All of these, I guess, are just daily things, terms and labels that you use in your profession. But what do you think of some of those labels?
Well, there's still, at least in the United States, and I believe in New Zealand as well, and other parts of the world, people who might say something like, I don't want to label someone, or I don't want to be labeled. I think the problem is when people are inappropriately labeled, because to begin a good treatment, one has to have at least a ballpark idea of what the diagnosis is. Because by giving a specific diagnosis, What we're saying is that we're tapping into a body of research knowledge which may be somewhat limited, may be greater in some areas, something that's growing, something that's changing, something that's developing, but we're tapping into research that is telling us something about what's the natural history of this illness untreated. How might we treat this disorder? Might this disorder be passed on to other people? So starting with the proper label, we start to be able to fashion a treatment plan and be able to tell people what to expect on the whole.
So fashioning that treatment plan is critical, and I guess the important thing is to have a correct diagnosis.
Right. Diagnosis alone does not make a treatment plan. It's not ipso facto, you have schizophrenia, you should get this treatment. You have bipolar disorder, you should have that treatment. There are other factors that go into it. But certainly, that sort of painting with a broad strokes, that's the place to start on the canvas.
Yeah.
And then you go from there in terms of figuring out, for an individual patient, what might work and what might not work.
So the diagnosis being important in mental health, is that because there's a degree of overlap between, say, bipolar disorder and depression, but they have to be treated in a different way?
When we talk about diagnosis, so we talk about our diagnostic system, the one that's used in the United States primarily is something called the DSM-4. In Europe, they use the ICD-9, and I believe in New Zealand they primarily use the DSM-4 as well. Really doesn't classify people. It classifies diagnoses. It tells you not the difference between one person who happens to have schizophrenia and one person who happens to have bipolar disorder, but it tells you the difference between schizophrenia and between bipolar disorder. Many of these disorders overlap. So it sort of shows the overlap, it shows the distinction, and it gives us a basic idea, again, I think primarily of one, where to start treatment if we're using it in clinical settings. And if we're using it in other settings, particular research settings, suppose a drug company has a new potential wonder drug for treating schizophrenia, it gives us some guidelines as to what is it that we all agree upon is schizophrenia. So don't put the wrong patients in the study, because once you do that and you have the wrong patients in a study, chances are you're going to have negative studies. And many of the studies, the way they're done these days, are done on multiple sites, and they may even be done in multiple countries. So there may be sites doing the same study in Australia, France, Italy, New Zealand, all at the same time. You need to have agreement as to what you call schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in Paris should be what you call it in Akaroa.
Does that happen?
Yes. That's a big part of research. And there are actually tools developed and training developed specifically to get at that issue, that there is agreement as to what we mean by these terms, such as so-called reliability of diagnosis, meaning that at least people agree this is what we call it and this is how we go about defining it.
In your lengthy experience of psychiatry, have you seen a wonder drug in mental health?
I don't know if I've seen a wonder drug in mental health. I think that we've learned how to cut up the pie a little bit better, how to subdivide the different diagnoses or problems in such a way that we can match up certain treatments a little better and also understand how certain treatments or certain issues may actually worsen certain conditions. So I don't think that there's any wonder drug. There have been certain drugs that have been particularly helpful for particularly, let us say, more refractory or the more difficult to treat patients. There may be different names that we use for these drugs in the United States, but certainly one of them in schizophrenia would be Clozaril, also known as clozapine. We're seeing a lot of promise in forms of bipolar disorder with a drug called Lamictal or Lamotrigine. So I wouldn't say there's any wonder drug, but we're getting better at diagnosing, subdividing, and matching up treatments to certain diagnoses.
I mean, in my personal experience, depressive, antidepressive medication today seems to be a lot less lethal physically on yourself than it used to be in the age of tricyclic.
Right. In fact, you bring up a very astute point, and that is that if you look at the newer generation antidepressants, there's not convincing evidence that they're better on the whole in terms of getting people out of depression, but they're a lot safer and have a lower burden of side effects than the older drugs. So in the old days, if you would take essentially the equivalent of a month's worth of tricyclics, it was very easy to kill yourself, whereas most of the newer drugs that we use, the SSRIs and related drugs, you can take quite a bit. I'm not challenging anyone out there, but you can take quite a bit without killing yourself or harming yourself significantly. So they become much safer drugs to use.
I'd have to say I felt pretty dead on those tricyclics for the first 3 weeks or
so. Sure, you can have, look, you can have bad side effects with almost any drug, yeah. But on the whole, the newer drugs have much less side effects than the older drugs.
So that is what would you regard that as being an advancement?
It's a great advancement because also it allows non-specialists, non-psychiatrists, general practitioners, pediatricians, gynecologists to feel much more comfortable themselves to treat depression than in the older days because they see it as a easier endeavor because it's a safer endeavor than it used to be. So I think in that sense in particular, a consequence of having these safer drugs is that one does not have to be as specifically trained in their use. Hopefully one knows what they're doing. I'm not saying that they don't, but that people are more willing who are not expert psychopharmacologists to often embark on treatment with some of the newer drugs and some of the older drugs we had 20 years ago.
Just in talking about depression, is the incidence of depression on the increase?
There's actually very convincing data that throughout the 20th century, depression has been on a steady increase. Not just that we call it such, not just that it's recognized, but that actual depression is increasing and it's showing up in younger and younger people, severe depression.
I gather that your mentor talked about Agent Blue.
Right, a famous professor in the United States, a fellow named Jerry Klarman, who I worked for through Harvard University for a number of years, did some seminal research in this area about the increase in depression. And when he used to lecture, he used to talk about Agent Blue as the unknown agent, because we don't know why. There's some various hypotheses why depression may be on the increase, but essentially it's not known why. And it's also seen, when it's been looked at, not only in urban modern societies, but even in third world countries and very agrarian parts of Norway, rural parts of Korea and Puerto Rico, where people have looked at it using the same methodology, have found the same thing, that depression is on the increase. So it can't only be explained by sort of modern living. There's something going on out there. It's unclear what.
Just to clarify, did that research indicate that even in agrarian Korea or agrarian Asia, that depression was greater, the incidence was greater?
Where it was looked at, it was shown to be greater. And I know of a study done in Korea. I know of a study done in Puerto Rico. I know of a study done in Norway. And there may be other studies that have used similar methodology and have similar findings. But I know of those research studies that specifically were there to counterbalance some of the studies that have been done in the United States to see about how these disparate populations with different cultures and attitudes and whatever, genetics and whatever, may be reacting.
So even though they didn't live in high-rise cities and have all the stress and pressure of New York City, perhaps,
right,
they still showed similar symptoms?
Yes, and also we know that in indigenous certain peoples, Pacific peoples, others around the world are showing increased rates of suicide, where 30 years ago the suicide rates of third world people used to be much lower compared to, let's say, the European-based populations that may have been of the higher socioeconomic strata. Unfortunately, other people are catching up.
Well, we'll come back after our first music break to talk more to Dr. Del Tito, but we'll listen to a track from Roy Brown, and let's play that right away.
Headstones are in the heart, memories are in the soul. Headstones are in the heart, memories are in the soul. I've never been to your garden. I've never planted your rose. I've never knelt to worship. A monument of stone. Headstones are in the heart. Memories are in the soul. Headstones are in the heart. Memories are in the soul.
Well, that's Roy Brown, who we've been playing regularly on Take It From Us, Headstone in the Heart, from his Golden Blue CD. And Roy is from the Lighthouse Trust in the Hawke's Bay. Now, last week we paid tribute to a Dr. Jill Calverley from Harbour Health. And the person, she was actually a guest on Take It From Us, and the person that recommended that Take It From Us get in touch with Jill Calverley was Lorna Murray from Connect Supporting Recovery. And Lorna has sent us a tribute to Jill Calverley that I would like to read here. And it says, family, friends and colleagues were shocked by the sudden and untimely death of Jill Calverley in her sleep on the 30th of December. Jill is well known to the mental health sector, particularly in Waitemata, where she has been a passionate supporter and promoter of development in primary mental health for decades. Jill was most recently employed as clinical director for Harbour Health after a long career as a general practitioner, and various roles in developing services in primary and secondary care, as well as planning and funding. People who worked in the sector will remember her for her holistic and comprehensive approaches to health and well-being. Jill contributed to much planning and development within mental health, but she always stressed how important it was to think about the issues of the whole person, and avoiding pigeonholing people into categories like mental health and the elderly. And I'm sure our guest today, Joe Del Tito, would support that view. Her energy, enthusiasm and collaborative nature contributed much to the development of primary health options, helping people to get early intervention and prevent mental ill health. Colleagues who attended her funeral were astounded to find that the energy and commitment that she had to her work were replicated in her leadership of Writing for the Disabled, for which she received the Queen's Service Medal, and her inspirational parenting and grandparenting of her family, as well as being an adventure sports and yoga enthusiast. This was celebrated during her funeral, which was held at the Writing for the Disabled Centre, complete with horse guard. Guests were invited to get to their feet and try out some of the yoga moves. I'm sure that she was smiling down as folk were actively doing something together to make themselves feel better. And that's a tribute to Dr. Jill Calverley from Lorna Murray, the CEO of Connect Supporting Recovery. Now today on Take It From Us, we are talking to Dr. Joseph Del Tito, and I won't repeat his credentials, but he is a forensic psychiatrist and physician, and also media commentator and social and cultural commentator. Yeah, we were talking about the research that's being done about the incidence of depression, and just go back to having a Nigerian mental health worker in the studio here, and he proclaimed that Nigeria is supposedly one of the happiest countries in the world, and I said, gee, that's pretty surprising. But he said, well, people just appreciate what they have. Whatever they have, they appreciate. And I think it's your view, Joe, that our expectations are too great.
Well, there have been some people who have posited that part of depression as a public health issue may arise out of people who have increased expectations with diminished abilities to achieve those expectations, or what life may bring them or something like that. I think that these social factors more mold depression than really cause it. And Nigeria may be an exceptionally happy place. I think some survey I saw recently voted Denmark the happiest country. But if you looked closely in Denmark or Nigeria, and I don't know this for a fact, my guess is that you'd find probably the same rates of depression that you'd find in other countries. Yeah. And maybe the people who aren't depressed are more happy. And maybe the people who aren't depressed, well, they're not depressed, are more happy. Right. But I'd be very surprised if the rates, the base rates of depression, weren't quite similar.
What tips would you give any of our listeners if they were feeling depressed right now?
Okay, when we're talking about depression, we're not just talking about sadness. When we're talking about diagnoses in general, we're talking about syndrome. What's a syndrome? A syndrome is an aggregation of symptoms that sort of hold together in a certain way. So when we're talking about depression, a lot of people just think of that as, well, they're very sad. They've lost their job, someone has died, the dog has died, something like that. And indeed, in the vernacular, the word depression is appropriate to use. But clinically, when we talk about depression, we're talking about a disorder that usually presents with difficulty sleeping, eating, concentration, energy. And if there's any one core symptom of depression, the fancy word for that is anhedonia. Anhedonia is the inability to enjoy the usual pleasure-giving things. So if someone, an older person, really enjoyed seeing their grandchildren, they're not interested in seeing them anymore. If someone liked to eat a good lasagna or something like that, they're not terribly interested in it. If someone was a fisherman or a bowler or whatever, a knitter, whatever they usually do, or watching movies or interest in sex and romance or whatever, the usual things that people enjoy in life, they just can't get that sense of pleasure. That's sort of the core symptom with these other symptoms around it. And if this is what they have, especially if they should have black thoughts that they don't want to continue living or whatever, they should see a competent mental health professional who can steer them in the right direction and give them the right treatment. Especially, I would say, if there's a family history for depression.
So sometimes it's not easy to get in to see somebody immediately. you know, what little things could they change in their life? I'm sure that at times you give this advice to...
Sure. There's some general advice, and often what my patients, when they ask me for advice, I put it under the heading of avoid your mother-in-law. And by avoid your mother-in-law, I generally mean that while you're depressed, you should avoid vexatious people who are annoying. You should try to remove some of the stressors as best you can. If you can take time off from work, not everyone can, do that. Be around the people that make you feel better. Certainly try not to be isolated. Beware of excesses in alcohol or other substances. So these are, I think, some general advice. Maybe it doesn't cure depression, but it might help the course of depression, especially before anyone gets into any kind of formal treatment.
Yeah, and it's ironic, isn't it, that often our mates will say, oh, come on, let's go and have a beer.
And that is helpful sometimes, but sometimes it's not. In true, full-blown depression, that sort of let's have a beer, let's go out to the horse races or whatever you have here, you know, can be helpful, usually in the context of someone who's had a loss. They've lost their job, they've lost their mother.
Or their mother-in-law.
No, not their mother-in-law. maybe their chihuahua or something like that has run away. That type of thing can be quite helpful, to be around your mates, to do the things that you enjoy or whatever. Even if you yourself are not moved to do it, to get someone to move you to do it might be helpful. But in full-blown depression, someone can take you to the horse races and it doesn't matter. Someone can take you to the casino and it doesn't matter. So, yes, if you're sort of more what I would call demoralized because bad things have happened in your life, that let's go get a beer can be very helpful. But in true depression, it usually doesn't do much.
Now, our listeners may have heard that little word that came out there, chihuahua, and I think that's got a special significance. Perhaps, Joe, you might like to explain that.
No, we were joking beforehand and saying that when I'm on TV, sometimes I tell people that I'll give them some secret message and use a low-frequency word. And once on CNN, I described in a forensic case that a fellow was trying to cover up the murder and running around the house frenetically like a chihuahua on crack, and that was a term that sort of got incorporated into the lingo at CNN.
Well, chihuahua on crack actually ended up on the T-shirts, didn't
right.
it?
Right, it did.
Yeah, so getting back to our more serious questions, depression, is it afflicting younger and younger people?
It is, both what we call unipolar depression, where people suffer from depressive episodes alone, and people who have bipolar depression, where they suffer either from episodes of depression or sort of the opposite of depression, where they're abnormally euphoric, high, irritable, full of energy, in a negative sort of way. So both bipolar disorder and unipolar disorder look like they're afflicting younger and younger populations than they did, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
It would be great if we could tap into that more energetic, more manic state without having the downsides and the dumps, wouldn't it?
Well, in mild mania, which we technically call hypomania, yes, can be quite helpful in certain ways, but by its inherent nature, it tends to be unstable, and then people tend to get in trouble because of it. You know, they get into sexual relations that they shouldn't. They spend money that they shouldn't. They get into business ventures that they shouldn't, etc. They lose jobs. So, yes, to be a little more set up in your humor, a little more up, a little more insightful, etc., can be a good thing. But by its very nature, it tends to be unstable. If you look at a lot of sort of famous people that have been sort of at sort of the top of their game, whether it be in business or science or the arts, you find a tremendous amount of people with bipolar disorder, just in general. I mean, people know Ted Turner here, you know, the fellow who founded CNN, famous sailboat racer, so I guess you would know him here in New Zealand. He has bipolar disorder. I'm not saying anything that isn't public knowledge. It appears people who do these sort of historical dissections, Abraham Lincoln, Michelangelo, Winston Churchill, all seem to be people who suffered from bipolar disorder, Columbus. And probably for the society, it's helpful to have some people that can have some vision and energy and sort of say, okay, guys, let's all get together and let's sail this way and we'll get to China and whatever, and convince people of things that ordinarily you'd never be able to convince people of. It might be harmful for the individual, but it may be helpful to the society to have a certain percentage of people who have these bipolar traits, and they tend to be very good scientists. People have insights, can think outside the box and whatever, but they're often very troubled souls.
What would you say to the requirement to have a few of those in the States to get over the credit crunch?
Well, I don't know if we need some bipolar people. I think we need people that show more restraint. I think it was the excesses that led us into our problems. But we've got a new president, I think, starting today. And I didn't vote for him, but I wish him luck, and I hope he does a good job. And I hope 4 years from now I'll say, wow, this guy was a great president. I'm going to vote for him this time.
So we could have a theory that there were a lot of manic depressives that took us into this credit crisis.
Well, I think there were a lot of thieves that took us into it, and a lot of people who were corrupt. If you want to have a show on that, I can get into it. I think on both sides of the political aisle, there were people looking more for their own interests than the interests of the country.
Well, there was a certain hedge fund gentleman who seems to definitely have had that attitude.
Yeah, Madoff, who made off with $50 million.
Yeah. Well, we'd better take a break for another music track, and we're going to play Aaron Pearson, who runs workshops on hearing voices. We've played this track before, and it's I'm Just a Little Mad.
Just a little mad. I'm just a little mad. I'm just a little mad. I'm just a little mad. I had a shock, taking stock, regaining my control. Your deception is my perception, and I'm tired of being told that I'm just a little mad. I'm just a little mad, just a little mad. I'm just a little mad. I'm just a little mad. You tag me, you nag me to fit into your mold. Lost my rights, I cannot fight. I was back out in the cold. And that's why I'm just a little mad. I'm just a little mad, just a little mad. Just a little man, I said I'm just a little man. Angry, lost of family, lost of friends. You said I lost my mind. Got a job no more, give me pills galore. But now I'm breaking out of this bind. And that's why I'm just a little mad. I'm just a little mad, just a little mad. I'm just a little mad, yeah. I'm just a little mad. Now I've got a voice, and it's my choice. I have a right to have a say. Now I'm making it, I'm taking it, so don't stand in my way. No, and I'm just a little man. I'm just a little man, just a little man. I'm just a little man. I said I'm just a little man, got my own dreams. Just a little man. I'm just a little man. I'm just a little man. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Just a little man. I'm angry. Just a little man.
that's Aaron Pearson with I'm Just a Little Mad, and we have in the studio today probably our most high-powered mental health professional that we've ever had on Take It From Us. He's Dr. Joseph Del Tito, and he's a guest of the Phobic Trust here. And I was explaining about Like Minds Like Mine, which is our sponsor of this Take It From Us show, and about discrimination and stigma, and just wanted to talk a little about, you know, psychiatric illness and whether it's still more feared than physical illness, Joe.
Yeah, if by feared you mean that there's a certain stigma associated with it, people are fearful of other people finding out that they have a mental illness, I think that that's true. I think it's exceptionally unfortunate. And in many ways, it's silly because... I mean, the only thing, I wouldn't say it's silly because it's so unfortunate, you know, to use such a word, but it's silly in the sense that if you look at the major psychiatric illnesses, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, these are no different in my mind than someone having thyroid disease or diabetes or heart disease or Parkinson's disease or whatever. These are biologically determined diseases. People don't do things to get them. They don't occur in bad people or something like that. Yet there remains a lot of stigma associated.
One of the myths, of course, is that people with psychiatric illness are insane and criminally insane and are unstable and likely to do criminal things.
Well, there are... If you look at it the other way, if you look at people who are criminals and who do particularly heinous things, you will find a certain percentage who do have formal psychiatric disorders. But if you look at it the other way, of the people that have formal psychiatric disorders, how many of them are criminal? It's a very, very, very small percentage. So there is some truth to that conceptualization. There's no doubt people who kill... for the sake of killing or abduct people or cannibalize them or whatever, often have formal psychiatric illnesses. It sounds sophomoric for me to even say that, but they're so infrequently countered in the population. I think by seeing popular TV and movies, we think that there's a lot more of these people out there. You know, Hannibal Lecter from Silence and the Lambs, there's maybe three Hannibal Lecters in the world, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, but the way it's portrayed on TV, people would think every thousandth person was a Hannibal Lecter or something like that.
So, I mean, that sort of raises the issue of how the media handles mental health, isn't it? And I mean, I guess you've played a part in moderating the extreme sort of perceptions that the media can portray about mental health.
Yeah, there are often very inaccurate portrayals of mental health, of mental health practitioners. I've always been suspicious that, in Hollywood at least, that a lot of people who are very much involved, directors, writers, themselves have unstable and ambivalent relationships with psychotherapists, with psychiatrists, and you more often see the psychiatrist as an evil figure, someone who's conniving, as opposed to someone who's just trying to help someone. There are not that many positive portrayals of psychiatrists, yet most psychiatrists, psychologists are rather nice people who are trying to help people. They don't have some evil agenda. In fact, they're people who have devoted their lives to helping people, either through treatment or research.
So what happens socially when you say you're a psychiatrist or a forensic psychiatrist? I mean, that word forensic seems to have a scary connotation about it to me anyway.
I'm not sure what happens. And my own identity is not as necessarily a psychiatrist. In fact, it's interesting that usually I don't introduce myself as a psychiatrist, not because I see anything wrong with it. I generally introduce myself as a doctor, because I see psychiatry merely as a branch of medicine. So if people ask what I do, or I'm filling out my form for entry into the country and they say profession, generally I put down doctor instead of psychiatrist. Not that I see anything wrong with being a psychiatrist.
Right. Yeah, when parents have to face the diagnosis of one of their children with a psychiatric disorder, what are some of the things that might happen for those parents?
Well, there's this old idea that a lot of psychiatric disorders, especially some of the more significant ones like schizophrenia, are the result of somehow poor parenting. And this is an idea that should have died a long time ago. I mean, there's no doubt that if you have children who are absolutely savaged when they were very young, raped, beaten, that this can have profound effects upon their later life, adaptation, personalities, temperament, trust of people, etc. But in terms of average, everyday raising of children, obsessive-compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, there's no evidence that these things are caused by somehow poor parenting. And often the parents are reticent to take in children to see a psychiatrist or whatever, I think because they're afraid that they're going to be blamed for the disorder. And this, again, is an idea that should die, and it should die quickly. But it's taking a long time to die.
Are you saying that that blame doesn't happen today?
No, I'm saying that the blame happens in certain sectors, but it's unwarranted because the research data simply does not support that position.
What about if the parent has had a psychiatric illness and the child ends up with it? I mean, I've seen a figure which suggests that 20% of people, children, will inherit a mental illness. Is that a fact?
It depends. Certain diseases tend to have a stronger genetic component than others. Certainly in certain forms of depression, panic disorder, agoraphobia, bipolar disorder, we see a strong genetic component. Schizophrenia, interestingly, which was felt to be primarily a genetic disorder, recent data suggesting that genetics play actually less of a role in schizophrenia, and current thinking is pointing more and more to interuterine, sort of nonspecific interuterine problems while the person is a fetus, leading to the later development of schizophrenia.
I've just lost my train of thought there, but I was just thinking, let's take a music break, because
okay,
there was something that I wanted to ask you very specifically, and let's listen to a track from Luke Hurley.
Please don't lean on my machine. Make a deal.
well, we're back on air with Dr. Joseph Del Tito, and I just had a little brain explosion there because I wanted to ask Joe about schizophrenia and when it was realised, what age it was realised. I thought it was somewhere between the 20s and 30s, but Joe's saying that it's probably younger than that. And I just wanted to ask, I mean, that must have a huge impact on somebody of the age of sort of between 16 and 25.
Well, it tends to be a profound disorder, but like all disorders, medical and psychiatric, there are some people who can have milder versions and people that have more severe versions. So again, just by getting a diagnosis of schizophrenia does not mean that you're going to have a severe, crippling, downward spiral type disorder, although many people do. But with, if recognized early and given aggressive and appropriate treatment, most people with schizophrenia these days can lead rather happy, productive lives. Maybe with episodes now and then when they decompensate, and maybe not cured is not the word we would use, but definitely controlled much more than they were, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
How important is it to strike early?
It's very important to strike early. Not only because of the biological nature of the disorder and sort of aborting whatever is going on in the central nervous system, but also to abort, if you will, someone who may be going years in a socially or occupationally compromised way so that they're not going through the normal contingencies of life which educate and toughen us up and give us some savvy about how to interact with people. So the person who at age 16 may have schizophrenia, hallucinate, be very reclusive, is not going on his first date, is not interviewing for his first job, is not completing university, is not learning how to deal with coworkers, figuring out who to trust and not to trust. So you get, you can get something which my colleague who works here in Auckland, a very fine psychiatrist named Nick Argyle, calls delayed development. You know, from the disorder, from a number of disorders. So not only is it the disorder itself, but the disorder can keep people from having these seminal experiences that are important in our development. So you can think of the difference between someone who at age 16 starts to get ill and the disorder is more or less controlled by the time he's 18, as opposed to the person who at 16 starts to have problems and doesn't get any adequate treatment until he's 40. Big differences just from the point of view of what they've missed out on.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the issue of phobias, and you're here really as a guest of the Phobic Trust. What is a phobia?
A phobia is an irrational fear which causes a certain significant level of distress or disability to someone. So you would not use the word phobia for something that someone should be honestly afraid of, you know, an actually venomous snake right in front of them at the moment. That's not a phobia. That's an honest fear. But a phobia would be an irrational fear where there really isn't the potential harm. And we generally divide phobias into three categories. I mean, you can cut up the pizza pie in all sorts of different ways, 6 slices, 8 slices. But generally speaking, we start with 3 slices. One is agoraphobia, and this is somewhat similar to what many people will know as claustrophobia. They're people who are afraid of closed-in spaces, who find it hard to go out of a safe zone, have a feeling of dread if they're not with someone they feel comfortable with, often end up housebound, and most of these people have what we call panic attacks, at least initially in their disorder, where they're having intense crescendo anxiety episodes that last usually just for a few minutes at a time, but are very fearful. Then there are people who have social phobias, which is a sort of social timidity, fear of interacting with people because they're going to be adjudicated, judged harshly, so that they have difficulty interacting with people, dating in particular, establishing romantic sexual relations is particularly sensitive to people who have social phobia, also occupational work issues. And then the third category are called simple or specific phobias, and these are generally phobias of certain objects, situations, animals. The most common would be of small mammals, reptiles, and insects. And then you can throw into there things like fear of heights, fear of blood, and whatever. I mean, there are the way you divide up the pizza pie, you can divide it up into hundreds of slices, often with elaborate Greek names, arachnophobia, fear of spiders or whatever. Usually most adults don't come into treatment for simple phobias. They generally come into treatment for agoraphobia or social phobia.
Where do the eating disorders fall into those three pizza slices?
Well, eating disorders overlap a lot with other anxiety disorders, particularly with what we call obsessive compulsive disorder and certain variants of obsessive compulsive disorder. An obsession is an intrusive, unwanted negative thought that someone can't banish from their mind in the normal way, like I'm getting contaminated by shaking someone's hand, like did I really turn the key off in the car in the garage, or is it continually going? It's an irrational, intrusive thought that cannot just be banished. And in eating disorders, we see a lot of these sort of irrational thoughts of an obsessive nature. Now, I'm not saying that eating disorders are just a variant of OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, but there's a great overlap there, particularly among the anxiety disorders with obsessive-compulsive disorder. I just saw someone in the States last week that, you know, her mother had to put one drop of oil in the frying pan and not three drops of oil when she cooked the vegetables. You know, this very sort of rules-bound, specific ways. People have to do things in a ritualistic way. If they're worried about being contaminated, they tend to wash, but they often wash. They have to take the bar of soap in their left hand first. They have to wash their hands and rinse them 13 times, not 12, not 14. Why 13? They don't know, but that's the right number. So there's this irrational aspect to their worries because of these intrusive thoughts that tell them they're at risk, they're at danger, something's intruding, something's harming them, and that overlaps a lot with eating disorders, as well as a general sense of anxiety, because anxiety in and of itself is a ubiquitous finding in almost all psychiatric disorders, many existential states, and many medical disorders as well.
So these phobias are classified as a mental illness?
Yes, they would be milder forms of mental illness, and they tend to be forms of mental illness that we can treat rather well. So most people, well, especially with the phobias and panic disorder, we can really treat the vast majority of those people really well to really almost eradicate and sometimes eradicate the problem. OCD, we can get most people a lot better, although often with a little bit of residual symptoms with our current knowledge of how to treat these people.
But when you use the term, say, milder, and I gather I'm using the right term, I mean, these phobias can be life-threatening.
Oh, no, they can be quite life-threatening, and they can be quite life-altering, and they can be quite severe, especially when not treated. And people become housebound. Many people don't come clean, if you will. They don't tell their families exactly what's going on, so the person with agoraphobia may always be making excuses for not going to family functions, and they use different names for strange or crazy Aunt Lucy who just won't go out of the house or something like that, where what they have is might be rather garden variety agoraphobia, which with proper treatment, the type of things that are done at the Phobic Trust and other places can usually blossom and do quite well.
Is there an age group where these phobias are more likely to strike?
The simple phobias we tend to almost always encounter in childhood, and then most of them dissipate with age and then develop. They may last, some of them, into adulthood, but you generally don't see a simple phobia start in adulthood. In fact, when you have something like what looks like a simple phobia that starts in adulthood, it's almost always more appropriately considered a form of what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. So the person who is attacked by a group of dogs is now, let us say, somewhat fearful and reticent of dogs. Someone might call that a dog phobia, but that's really something else. Mm. That's really the effect of the specific trauma. Social phobia, agoraphobia, and panic disorder generally first start showing themselves again around age 16, 17, 18, 20.
Mm. Well, it's been a fascinating discussion, and one that certainly has required me to stay on track. Thank you very much, Joseph Del Tito, for coming in. It's a long way from New York, but it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Just want to mention that there is a tribute to Mahinarangi Toka at the Winter Garden on Sunday. I haven't actually got all the detail, but if you rang the Mental Health Foundation, I'm sure that they would give you the detail there. So that's a tribute. Her whānau and family will be there. I believe there'll be a number of musicians who will be contributing. Winter Garden on Sunday. And that's been Take It From Us.